Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse, and we are covering a very controversial but very exciting subject today. We have Leslie Kane with us, an investigative journalist who's been published internationally and nationally in the Boston Globe, in the Baltimore Sun, in The Nation, in the International Herald Tribune, in the Journal of Scientific Exploration. She is the author of a breakthrough book called UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Michel Kaku has also given her a wonderful highlight at the beginning of the book, and he says, at last, a serious and thoughtful book about this controversial subject. Skeptics and true believers will find a treasure trove of insightful and eye-opening information. This book is bound to set the gold standard for UFO research. Leslie Kane has also been part of a documentary called I Know What I Saw. She is the founder of the Coalition for Freedom of Information and is going to talk to us about a five-year lawsuit against NASA. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Leslie Kane to It's Rainmaking Time. Good morning.
Good morning. It's wonderful to be with you.
I'm so delighted. I've been interested in UFO phenomenon on a forensic and technical level, very much like you've communicated in your book, as well as on a cosmology level, which I really felt that you were very mindful how you addressed all that. And I'd really like to begin this interview today with the distinction you make on page 10 and 11 between a UFO and a UAP. And I'd like you to explain that to the public.
Sure. And, you know, there really isn't a lot of difference between the two, between a UAP and a UFO. But what's interesting is that they're basically two acronyms for the same thing, although the UAP is a little bit broader, actually, in its definition. It stands for Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, and it's a term that's been selected by a lot of scientists who don't like the sort of baggage that comes along with the word UFO, because it has so many associations of being something sort of silly, and it has all the cultural associations with sort of, you know, the media taking it lightly, and when scientists want to take the subject very seriously, they just want to sort of step away from that. So a number of them have adapted the term UAP instead, and a number of them who have written for the book, and we have original pieces in the book by officials and high-level people, some of them have exclusively used that term. But I think readers can think of it pretty much as meaning the same thing as UFO. There's not a lot of difference.
But the distinction allows the scientists to forensically study what these phenomena are on a scientific level rather than on a cosmology level, which can detract from the forensic level. Am I correct?
Yeah, I mean, the way I would say it is that it allows them a sort of to put forth a terminology that they feel comfortable with because it doesn't have the associations that UFO has. And, you know, unfortunately, the word UFO is misinterpreted to mean something extraterrestrial or to mean an alien spacecraft. That's what most people think a UFO is by definition. And in fact, it's not. It actually just stands for unidentified flying objects, something that one sees in the sky, which, you know, we can't identify through our normal, in terms of what we normally consider to be something that one would see in the sky. I mean, it's something that really is unidentified. And because it's had this association with the extraterrestrial implications of it, that's why the scientists have chosen to use UAP, some of them, because it doesn't have as much connotation towards something otherworldly the way the word UFO does. It's really just a question of terminology.
Whatever this phenomenon is on a forensic level certainly appears, even in your translations and the interviews in the book, as being some type of an aerial object that is operating as if not from this planet. That's for sure, correct?
Yeah, it certainly appears that way. I mean, if you eliminate all possibilities for what it could be, and in some of the cases there's so much data that you can kind of eliminate any other possibility for it except something that is completely unexplained and unknown to us. And I think the most logical, you know, deduction to make, which a number of these high-level officials have also made and are very open about, is what they call the extraterrestrial hypothesis, is the fact that it's coming from somewhere else outside of the planet Earth. And it seems like a pretty big statement to make, but you kind of are left with not much alternative when you read some of these cases. So you're stuck with that. And although, you know, we don't want to assume it because it hasn't been actually proven to the extent that, you know, is really needed, but nonetheless, it seems like a very rational and valid explanation for what we're observing.
I think the more you create space to study scientific phenomenon, the more evidence you'll be able to compile. I mean, there's a lot of evidence all over the world for so many years about what we're addressing and what you addressed in this book, but there isn't the professional space to come out and come forward. That's why I thought this was exciting also in the book. And page 13 of your book, you talk about principled skepticism is the foundational premise of this book. And you talk about astrophysicist Bernard, is it Heisch?
Bernard Heisch, yeah.
Bernard Heisch.
Heisch, yeah.
And he's the former science editor of the Astrophysical Journal and the Journal of Scientific Exploration. May I read what you wrote there as he defines a true skeptic? Because I think as a context, this is an important piece.
Please do. I really think he's got a great definition for it. So
he says, a true skeptic is one who practices the method of suspended judgment, engages in rational and dispassionate reasoning as exemplified by the scientific method, shows willingness to consider alternative explanations without prejudice based on prior beliefs, and who seeks out evidence and carefully scrutinizes its validity. And you called yourself a kind of agnostic relative to this subject. And I thought that was very interesting how you can step back, be dispassionate, not necessarily assert that this is a cosmology paradigm and go right into the scientific paradigm and create space there. You also talk about your five premises, but I wondered if you wanted to say something about what Bernard said.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a beautiful, beautifully clear definition of what a true skeptic is, as he says. And, you know, we have to distinguish between true skepticism versus what we call the skeptics when we're sort of talking about really about debunkers. And I think we have to make a distinction between genuine good skepticism versus the kind of debunking mentality, which means when somebody won't even be open and consider it, they've just already decided that this couldn't possibly be, and therefore they've written it off. And so when people talk about the skeptics, it's a word that I think is often misused. Really, we should all be skeptics, and anybody that has an inquiring mind really is a skeptic in the sense of this definition. So I think it's a really well articulated definition of it, and I see it as sort of the book being written for somebody who's in that kind of mind state, really, when they go through it.
I think that creating a context for what a skeptic is in the way that he describes it also allows people to ask the questions without being shunned. Really, it creates space for inquiry.
Exactly, I agree with you. And that's what I tried to do in my whole introduction, really, and this is part of the introduction that you were referring to, was really to create the space for somebody to feel completely safe in reading this book because they're not being asked to believe in anything that they can't believe in and to just sort of lay the groundwork in a way that I like your expression of creating space. I hope that's what I was able to achieve in the introduction, to sort of set the groundwork so that people don't have to feel threatened by moving forward into the book.
And I love that you talked about, a lot of times people ask the question, do you believe in UFOs? And how you assert that it's basically a baseless yet frequently asked question, and it creates endless problems in communication. So, for example, even me covering this subject on my show, because I do stuff about international finance, agriculture, climate and weather, I cover deeply a lot of subjects. It's a variety show. And I know that if some guests see that I'm covering this subject, that is even a potential drop in credibility. Oh, you're covering the subject of UFOs. As much as there's mystery and excitement and fascination, there's also associated irrationality to even talking about the subject.
You're right. And I have to say, Kim, I really commend you for being willing to do it, because you're right. There probably will be some listeners that will just immediately have that kind of knee-jerk reaction. And I'm just so glad that people like you are willing to talk about it. And I think any of those people who looked at this book with a foreword by John Podesta, you know, and five generals who have contributed to it and a former governor, will really, you know, I think they'll think twice about having that kind of reaction. So that's why I'm so thrilled that, you know, you're doing this, because I think we can cross a bridge and hopefully reach those kinds of people.
To me, it's all very exciting. And to me, being a receptive person, somebody who's receptive to open inquiry, exploration and discovery is very exciting. So I can't help myself.
Well, I'm so glad you like that, and I really commend you for it. That's terrific.
Thank you. Talk a little bit about the Coalition for Freedom of Information, the work that you started there and that are in the midst of now. If you would like to share about the lawsuit, just a little bit with NASA as a context for how serious you are in this effort, we'd like you to share something if you can today.
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to. This is actually kind of a lot of the background, too, that has led me to the producing this book, which is sort of the culmination of all these years of work. And one of the things I did was co-found a group called the Coalition for Freedom of Information. I think it was in 2002 that we started. And we were basically, it was an affiliation of people that were interested in setting up a really intensive Freedom of Information Act effort to get to the bottom of a UFO case. And what was unique about it was that we had the support of a television channel that was willing to put resources into it to hire a lawyer and a public relations firm and a professional research firm and all these people that could make up a really strong team. And we took on the Kecksburg UFO crash case, which was a case in 1965 of something that came down in this small town in western Pennsylvania, and pursued it through the Freedom of Information Act, because we have not received documents so far that have explained what this was. We ended up filing a lawsuit against NASA in federal court. And again, it's a long story. We could do hours of discussion just on this one topic.
Right. But and I hope later at some point you'll come back and talk about it in detail. But whatever you'd like to share regarding this, I think will be important.
Sure. And just to sort of give people the overview, that we did file a lawsuit because NASA was withholding lots of documents that we knew they actually had in their possession. And it took 4 years in federal court. We had a very supportive judge. We finally made a settlement with NASA in our favor. In fact, NASA had to pay the legal costs for us, so that certainly shows you whose favor it was. And they were required by the courts to release hundreds and hundreds of documents. And even unfortunately, none of them explained to us what the Kecksburg object was. But nonetheless, we felt very happy in the fact that we actually, as citizens, actually won this case. I mean, we have to use the word settled the case. But I think it was the first time, my attorney said it was the first time that a citizen without the assistance of Congress has actually been able to have this kind of success with a Freedom of Information Act case, and especially since it was a case regarding a UFO case. So the fact that this was able to go through the court system and have the result it did was very, very important, even though the actual documents we got were not what we were looking for. But we did learn a lot through those documents about how NASA was operating and how the whole space program is operating in the 1960s. So it was a lesson in history in terms of what we received. But so the whole thing was, you know, a very, very time-consuming and, I think, productive endeavor. And that's where John Podesta first came out as a supporter of the work that I was doing, was back in the early part of in 2002, 2003, because he believed so strongly in the people's right to information and an open government. So he came on board supporting this initiative, and as a result has actually written the foreword to the book, which has really been an important development. So that gives you an overview of that effort.
Do you think that NASA has changed that much since the 60s? I mean, don't you think they're still very, I should say, not open source, not transparent about the kind of work they're doing? And that's still one of the challenges in the whole relationship with NASA and the space program.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not an expert on that, because this is the only time I've ever tried to acquire information from NASA through the FOIA was back on this one specific case. So I don't really feel like I'm qualified to comment on
Got
that.
It.
But I can tell you that there are certainly problems with the Freedom of Information Act in general. And our experience with it was just such an illustration of that, of what citizens are up against in using this law that's supposed to be designed for their benefit, to allow them to access information that's rightfully theirs. And, you know, it's a very, very difficult process, and the agencies will often not respond in the way that they're required to respond under the law, and they get overwhelmed, and they don't have enough staff, and it's not well organized, and there's just so many problems within that system. So we certainly did learn that we do need reform in many agencies within their Freedom of Information Act offices. And, you know, it's just very difficult for people to have success with it. And I'm sure it's true at NASA. I'm sure it's true in other agencies also.
Sure. And I would imagine that once you have the National Security Agency and you create a law like the Freedom of Information Act, it's an instrument that supposedly allows you to deal with what really is a national security agency domain. You know, they consider it their domain. So I guess the National Security Agency will deal with it how they see fit in responding to things. And I wondered, are you optimistic at this point?
You know, I can't really say. I mean, I've so much shifted my attention now. I mean, we resolved this lawsuit in 2007, and then there was about a year afterwards in which I was receiving all these documents and processing them. And then I wrote up a final report in 2008 about the whole case and what we learned and what we got. And I have to tell you, since then, I've just so much moved on to working on this book. And so I don't really know, you know, what our next step is going to be in terms of the work of the coalition, quite honestly. And I'm just not as focused on it. And again, it was a very kind of narrow window because we were very specifically focused on this one case.
Got it.
So I've just sort of shifted my focus at this point to, you know, something really using the book as a tool to get the word out and also to try to affect change within the government. And that's sort of going to be the focus. And remember, much of the coalition, the coalition membership is also involved with this process as well. So that's sort of what our focus is now.
Do you remember when Dennis Kucinich spoke about his experience of seeing a UFO and a lot of people kind of laughed at him?
Yes, very well. That was during the presidential debates.
And I feel bad that he had the integrity enough to come forward and answer the question honestly, and then he got ridiculed tremendously for it. It really bothered me.
Me too. I mean, it bothered me too. I felt so much pain for him, and yet I also felt, you know, the courage that he has to be open about it, and that they were sort of baiting him. I mean, why did they even ask him the question in the first place? You know, I think the media loves to pick on Dennis Kucinich.
I think so, too.
You know, it's also just a mirror. And I actually had this little bit about him in the book. You know, sort of a mirror of where the culture stands on this issue. I mean, he just said straightforwardly, I saw something unidentified. It was a UFO. It was something unidentified. And people in the audience laugh. So, you know, it's just such a sort of, when you think about it rationally, it's a very strange situation that, you know, that's all he said. And they were laughing at him before he was even able to respond to the question. So
those groups anyway tend to be very tightly controlled. The dialogue and discourse for presidential dialogues is tightly controlled. So it didn't shock me that that audience was ridiculing him. It just bothered me, too. It bothered
me a lot.
You're
right. It didn't shock me either. It was the studio audience that was there to watch the debates. And, yeah, they're the types that would certainly laugh at something like this. I agree.
Talk to us about I Know What I Saw, that documentary, and your involvement in it.
Sure. It was an independent documentary directed and produced by James Fox, who was the filmmaker who made the film Out of the Blue, which some people might be familiar with, a number of years ago. And he basically, this is his second UFO documentary, and it was structured around a press conference that James Fox and I organized together back in November of 2007. And this was held in Washington, D.C., and there were about 14 panelists that we brought from around the world. Experts, again, officials, generals, high-level people to talk about UFO investigations, and some of them were actually the people that ended up writing pieces for my book in much greater detail, because this was just a press conference where they only talked for a few minutes. But it was, got a lot of coverage, and it was sort of a way for these men to also come together and meet each other. Again, people from all corners of the globe that are high-level involvement with this subject matter. So James made a film based on that press conference and kind of going off into various cases that the people presented there called I Know What I Saw. My involvement was basically, my biggest involvement was co-organizing the press conference with James. I wasn't really part of the film process. I was part of the organizing process for the press conference. And then I was a producer on the film, and that I assisted him in various production tasks that need to have happen to put a film together and to set up interviews and all that kind of stuff, and did some research for him, various tasks. But it really was his movie. He's the director. He was the producer of it. And it's well worth seeing. It was aired on the History Channel I believe it was in the fall of last year. And he also has it available on DVD on his website, which is iknowwhatisawthemovie.com. So if people are interested in it. And it does have a number of the people in the film who were also writers for my book, so it does give people who have read the book a chance to see what some of these guys are actually like.
What do you think has engaged the courage of so many people to come forward in these high-level positions? Do you think it's just that so much time has passed, they're no longer scared? What is it? Why are they coming forward? What do they think is going to happen from coming forward and talking with you?
Well, I think, of course, a number of them are retired. Most of them are. So at least they're not under the kind of restrictions they're under when they're not retired. So that sort of, in a way, frees them up. And I think these are people that really have conviction. I mean, when you've been either involved with this as an official investigator, like many of them have, or you've actually been a witness to it yourself, you have a certain conviction about wanting, first of all, wanting to find out what the thing is, wanting there to be more investigation. You want to get the word out there to people because they believe this is a very important issue. And I just think there's passion and conviction behind it for them because they've been so directly involved. And, you know, this is an opportunity. My book was certainly an opportunity for them to all come together in one place, in a framework, within the context of a narrative that they all felt very comfortable with because of the way I present the subject. I mean, they were totally simpatico with the approach that I had. And I think they just really want this to get out there, and they want to see a new level of investigation take place. And they believe in it. So because these people were not really taking any kind of huge risk in doing so, you know, because they are retired and free to talk about it, some of them anyway. And the others, they're just people that believe very strongly in getting the word out and are willing to risk whatever it takes to do that. And they have a lot of courage.
I thought it was fascinating to also find out about the Civil Aviation Authority, similar to our FAA, but a CAA in Britain, and how different the reporting systems are between U.S. and Britain. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure, and I agree with you, Kim. I think that is such an important point, and it's illustrated beautifully by two cases that are covered in the book, the O'Hare UFO case, which occurred in the United States in 2006, and then there was the one over the Channel Islands with a pilot flying a UK in the UK area in 2007, only 6 months apart. And basically, you know, the CAA, which is the equivalent of our FAA in Europe, has reporting forms available for pilots. If they see something, they file reports. They don't think twice about it. They'll land their plane. They'll submit a drawing, a detailed description, all the information from just the data that's needed to document the flight and where the things were. They'll find out if there was any radar. I mean, it's a process that is just very natural to these people and is built into their system. And, you know, this pilot, Ray Bowyer, who was involved with this 2007 sighting, which people may have heard about, was really amazed when he came over here in November of 2007 to our press conference and learned about the fact that American pilots are actually, you know, get the impression not to report these things. They don't report them. They're given messages not to do it. And as far as he was concerned, anything, and actually this is the rules over there, and these are the rules of the CAA, anything that could even be a possible danger to an aircraft, anything unusual, is to be reported. And it's a responsibility that pilots and crews have, and they do report these things. And, you know, also the other thing about this is when he reported it, the BBC got wind of this and they wanted to cover it. There was no problem with them doing that. The company that he worked for, the air company that he worked for, had no objections to him talking about this publicly on the BBC. They released the information on the case to a scientific group that wanted to study the case. And they were fully supportive of him going through this whole process. And it was not like it was some big deal like it is in America, where these pilots and crews don't even dare go on the record with their names, get the message they're not supposed to talk about this, don't file reports, have no reporting forms, and no place to go, and no support. And even when an event is a safety hazard, they're still not supposed to. In fact, the FAA manual states in black and white, this is the manual for all the employees of the FAA, that if you see a UFO, even if you think it's life-threatening, you are not to report it to the FAA. You're to report it to a UFO group. They give two groups in the manual that people can go to. So they're basically telling people outright, we don't want to hear anything about UFOs from any employee.
But it's, if something's occupying airspace and it's moving very quickly and could be a potential hazard or come into contact with someone in an airplane, how could you not say, as a pilot or co-pilot, this is what we're seeing? It doesn't even make sense,
right.
Does it?
I know, it doesn't make sense. And here they are being told by the FAA not to say anything about it. I mean, it is really, it's irrational, it doesn't make sense, and you might think even on the part of the pilots, but when their own manual tells them not to report them, they're certainly going to be confused. And in fact, Dr. Richard Haynes, who was a senior scientist from NASA, who has been studying pilot cases for decades, has reported and has learned that the vast majority of pilots do not report their sightings. They just don't report them. They're worried about job security and ridicule. Those are the two things. And so it's really a stark contrast between what happens in Europe, as we just explained, and you know, you can see it in the O'Hare case and the case over the Channel Islands. There's just a striking contrast. And we're hoping through this book that we can address that in a more public dialogue and see if something can be done about it.
Do you think that the FAA would be willing to sit down with you and other pilots and high-level officials from the military to get this out of their manual?
Boy, that would be great, wouldn't it? I mean, we're certainly going to try. That's the kind of change we want to make happen. And I think the chances are better now because of the power of this book and because of the response it's getting for that to happen. But, you know, there have been aviation groups such as Richard Haynes's group, which is an excellent scientifically based aviation safety group concerned about UFOs called the National Aviation, it's called NARCAP, the National Aviation Reporting Center for Anomalous Phenomena. They have been trying to approach the FAA and other aviation aspects of, you know, aviation unions and all kinds of groups, safety-oriented groups for a long time about this, and have not just really haven't gotten the response that they should have gotten. So there is a mountain of resistance within the aviation community, but we're going to keep beating on the wall, and maybe we'll be able to do it this time because of, you know, the impact of this book. That's what we're hoping.
And thank God for the internet, so hundreds of millions of people can participate in helping move your body of work forward in the book and get it to people who will eventually come forward. Have you ever been compared to Stephen Greer from the Disclosure Project? Have people ever asked you, are you doing kind of a version of that, but in a more scientific way? Have you ever heard of him?
I've heard of him, sure. I actually knew him years ago. I've never really been, I don't think I've been compared to him and been asked that question. I've never been asked that question before, but I actually, back when he gave his press conference in 2001, I believe it was, in Washington, I was involved in helping to set that press conference up. So I'm certainly familiar with him and, you know, have known him over the years.
When you spoke with Fife Symington III, the former governor of Arizona, I guess he doesn't plan to go back into politics because he was willing to come forward. And I was wondering if you could share a little bit about that, because that's somebody who has been directly involved in politics. And even though he's not the governor anymore of Arizona, he still came forward. And I thought that was profound.
Me too. I mean, I really think his transformation is profound and so fascinating because I don't know of any other political figure who was, you know, in the position comparable to his, who was also a witness, tried to ridicule the thing, and then came around later and completely reversed himself. It's pretty unusual. And just to let people know, and again, they can, in the book, you know, I've got all kinds of, he's written a piece for the book, and there's lots of information and things he has talked to me about that are represented in the book. But to put it in a nutshell, he was governor of Arizona during the Phoenix Lights incident of 1997, when hundreds, if not thousands, of citizens of Arizona witnessed these tremendous craft for about an hour and a half. He actually saw it himself, but as the governor, but never said anything about it. And a few months later, he held this famous press conference where he spoofed the whole thing, brought somebody out dressed up as an alien, hoping that he would sort of lighten the mood because there was what he called hysteria building in the state. There was such concern about this incident, and he didn't really know what to do. And again, this is a statement as to how inept our government is at handling this. This should have been the federal government should have stepped in on a case like this, but of course they didn't. So he did the best job he could to sort of try to lighten it up, not knowing what the thing was himself and not having been able to find any information out about it. And then 10 years later, he decided around the time of the 10th anniversary of this incident in 2007 that he would acknowledge publicly that he had actually been a witness to this event himself. And he does talk in the book about why he changed his mind and what he's gone through personally, and he really has become an advocate now for government change, for a new approach. And he's a powerful voice for this because he directly experienced the problems that occur when you don't handle this properly. He was in office, and it was a total mess, and he has made the statement that he would never want another governor to go through what he went through. And he said it's just a matter of time before it will happen again.
Weren't a lot of people angry with him when he was in office because he wouldn't allow the acknowledgement of what so many people witnessed to be validated in any way?
They were very angry at him, I think mainly because of his press conference, in which, as far as they were concerned, he was ridiculing the whole thing. You know, he brought out his chief of staff dressed up in a Martian outfit, and he announced before the press conference that he was going to present the answers. He said, "We've solved the problem of the Phoenix Lights. We're going to give you the answers." All the TV cameras were rolling, and then he brought this associate out in a Martian outfit and just made jokes about it. People were pretty upset about that, absolutely. And one of the reasons he decided to come forward 10 years later was just for that reason, that he felt badly about that. And he wanted to make amends to those people, and he really didn't mean to be ridiculing them, as he explains it now. He just was trying to lighten it up. He didn't know what to do about it. So he was very motivated by his desire to speak to the people that were upset about what he did and to kind of, make amends to them.
His story is a fascinating transformation, like you said. And I also think it's a beautiful microcosm, something that people in office can look at to think differently about how they would do that today, you know, what they would do today. And maybe the issue of disclosure in terms of the big D for disclosure maybe is further off when we think, but that the acknowledgement that there is aerial phenomenon that's unidentified, which we need to study more, which we need to have a space to acknowledge in the United States and in other countries that may still be lagging. But I think United States is the one that's dragging its feet on this the most, don't you?
Absolutely, I do. I mean, there's lots of countries we don't know anything about, really, in the rest of the world. But in terms of significant countries that could really, play an important role in this, I definitely agree. And the book is constantly highlighting the contrast between the United States and these other countries who have made progress but still feel they need United States participation to move forward with this. So I think you're absolutely right. And I do think that I'm hoping that Fife Symington's story will, as you suggest, encourage other officials to speak up about this. I mean, who knows which other elected officials have had dramatic sightings? I mean, Genis Kucinich was willing to talk about it, but there are probably others. So the book, hopefully, and especially Symington's piece and his comments can really help other people be willing to take a stand. And then ultimately, hopefully, we can change the U.S. government's position because they do lag behind. You're absolutely right.
Did you ever have any concerns for yourself in writing this book, or did you always feel a kind of comfort because people who have been in the skies are actually reporting what they've seen?
Yeah, I mean, by the time I got to writing this book, I really didn't have any worries about my own, myself in any way, because I'd been doing this for so long. I mean, I started this in 1999, and certainly in the beginning, I had all kinds of trepidations about it, professionally and about ridicule and all the things that one naturally worries about. But by the time I got to writing this book and really knew that these incredible officials, including five generals, were going to participate and actually write for the book, it just gave me a tremendous amount of confidence in the whole thing. So it's always a struggle to write a book, and it was an incredible amount of work. And sometimes I would doubt that, oh my God, am I doing it right? And will I ever get it done? And all the things that, you know, you worry about when you're doing something that's hard. But, you know, I wasn't really concerned or scared for myself in the way I think that you meant when you asked the question.
It's a very big book, too. It's almost 300 pages.
Right. And about half the book is original pieces, exclusive pieces written by other people. So I've written half of it, and I've framed everything for, you know, for the reader and yes. given it a cohesion and a narrative that holds it all together and given lots of information myself. But about half the book is these stories and, you know, accounts and explorations of cases and all the things that these other people have brought to the table here, which I think is one of the reasons the book's important, is because you have these exclusive first-person accounts written in their own words by these people. It's not me quoting them. It's them actually speaking directly to the reader. And that's one of the things that's really unique about the book and gives it a certain power, I think.
There was a gentleman that was flying a plane, a smaller plane. Was it Valentech? Valentich?
Yeah, Valentich.
Valentich,
yeah.
And I really would like you to just share a little something about that, because Valentich disappeared, and yet nothing really was done about it. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, this was a case that was presented in the book by Richard Haynes, Dr. Richard Haynes, again, a former senior scientist from NASA, who's an expert on aviation safety cases that are involving UFOs, and he researched this case in great detail, and actually the book provides a really chilling transcript of, I don't know if you remember that, Kim, of the conversation he had just before his plane went down.
I do.
Oh, my God. It's pretty chilling. And, you know, there's some kind of a big green metallic-looking lit green light that was flying around him and frightening him and sitting on top of his plane. And then eventually they just, he lost communications and his plane disappeared. And yeah, I mean, there was certainly, you know, they searched for his body and they did the sort of usual things that they do in a plane crash, but never found it.
They never found his body, or they never found the plane and his body?
As far as I don't think they ever found either one. I mean, they were pretty clear about where it probably fell in the water, and it would be the kind of thing you wouldn't expect to find because of the way the water was underneath, you know, the currents and the depth of the water, and I mean, it was a water thing. So it's not surprising that they wouldn't have been able to find it. I mean, that's the point. It's not like it mysteriously disappeared or something. But, you know, there was not a lot of investigation done, as you pointed out, except by Dr. Haynes, you know, which is often what happens. These individual experts, civilian experts or scientists, will jump in and do investigations because the governments don't do them. Although I think in Australia they're a little more focused on it than we are here. But, you know, it was just fascinating. Dr. Haynes went back and was able to find some witnesses who actually saw the thing from the ground, who witnessed the same green objects from the ground. So they were able to kind of corroborate the voice transcripts of the pilot, Valentich. And it's a famous case because, you know, the mysterious question, of course, that's raised is, you know, was this some aggressive behavior on the part of the UFO, or was it an accident? You know, we don't really know why this happened or what actually happened. All we have is the voice transcript. And again, I hope people will read that in the book, but it's a mystery because they don't know exactly what happened.
Are you still in touch with Dr. Haynes?
Oh, very much so, yes.
Is he still with NASA?
No, he's actually retired from NASA, but he heads up this group called NARCAP, which I mentioned earlier, and I highly recommend people to check that out on the web. It's narcap.org, NARCAP. He's very involved in some great research on aviation safety and UFO issues, and still very active, but he's no longer at NASA. He's retired.
Now, I noticed you had spoken also with Nick Pope, who had worked for the British Ministry of Defense for 21 years, from 1985 to 2006. And he's done a significant amount of research in this area. What drew you to Nick Pope, and what were your findings there that you can talk about?
Well, I mean, I've known Nick for quite a while, and really what drew me to him was the fact that he was an official. He was an MOD official who had this long career, as you just mentioned. And from 91 to 94, he was actually placed in charge of the Ministry of Defense's what they called UFO desk. Their little office within the Ministry of Defense that was specifically tasked with dealing with UFO cases. That was his full-time job. doing this for the government of Britain for 3 years. And when he first came on the job, he didn't know anything about the subject and was completely skeptical about it. And, you know, just was sort of took the job because it was offered to him, and they rotate these jobs. So, and it completely, another case of transformation. I mean, he became very seriously concerned about this during those years he was involved with the MOD there on the subject, and did some tremendous investigations, and was sort of transformed to became to realize that there really was a phenomenon here, that it was of defense interest, which is always a big question the UK government is concerned with. If it's not of defense interest, we're not going to be concerned with it. That's sort of their line. And he documents in his chapter in the book, he wrote a detailed chapter about what it was like for him when he was on this job and some of the cases he investigated, which were spectacular cases. He also reopened the Bentwaters, Rendlesham Forest investigation and did more work on that. So I've really been, you know, and he's been a real advisor to me and been a close colleague of mine for many years because of the fact that he is in this position of, you know, within the official world. He also has had access to information that he cannot talk about. So he is somebody who knows more than he's actually willing to talk about. What that is, I don't know, because he can't talk about it, but he's certainly someone who, because he was part of the government investigation into UFOs, certainly was shown and had access to lots of information that is still has not been released. So he's a great source of information and insight and perspective on the topic, very level-headed, and but really taken by it. And he's become one of the leading spokespeople in the world for the subject of UFOs. So I respect him a great deal.
What are the other countries that you're familiar with that have this kind of open, receptive stance toward documenting and allowing the disclosure of these findings? I know France is open to it.
Right.
What are other countries that, besides Brazil?
France is probably the number one country, actually, as I might have mentioned already, just because of their dedication to it for so many years and their actual scientific approach. It's not part of the military in France, so they have a very kind of research orientation to it as opposed to other countries which emphasize more safety or military aspects to it. Some of the other countries, we've talked about Britain,
yes,
and Belgium, of course. Belgium does not have a specific agency to deal with this, but they were very involved with it when they had their wave of sightings in the early 90s. But there are some South American countries that have also set up specific agencies just to deal with UFOs. One of them is Chile. They've set up an agency, and which is headed by General Bermudez, who has written a piece for the book. And Brazil does not have a specific agency, but their Air Force is extremely involved with this and has just recently come out with the announcement that they're going to release their documents. And other countries in South America, as well as Brazil and Chile, have, you know, they just sort of seem to be ahead of the game in South America. A number of countries have agencies there. And Peru is another one. They set up an agency within the Air Force in Peru to deal with this topic. So I think, you know, we can all look to South America and Europe. Those are seem to be the two areas. Other countries such as Russia have certainly released information about the subject. It's a little less clear in some of the other countries than it might be in the ones I mentioned. But the interesting thing, too, is that in the last, let's say, 8 years, many, many countries have decided to release all their UFO documents. And there's been sort of this flood of documents coming out of different countries, Scandinavia, Europe, South America, sort of almost like it's a trend, with the UK and France being the countries of most significance that have, you know, released all their documents, and the UK is still in the process of doing so. It takes a long time. So that's a really good development, that more and more documents are coming out.
And I think also that over time, over the last 50 years, that this has been kind of an evolution. And with the advent of the internet and the development of the internet, now the world can participate in being part of this transformation of inquiring about this, being able to talk about it, creating a space, being able to report on it, being able to capture photography of it, and to have testimonies are critical to general acceptance that these aerial phenomenon exists.
Right. I mean, the internet is so important. And, you know, the other point is about it that when these governments release their documents, they're generally released on the internet. I mean, people can go onto the Ministry of Defense website and access these government documents. And it's so important, as you're pointing out, because nobody's going to be able to get them in hard copy. It's just, you know. So this way, they can be made available to everybody very quickly, and as you said, there can be discussions and all kinds of places on the web where people can interact and pursue the topic. So yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to imagine what it would be like dealing with this if we didn't have the internet. It's really hard to imagine at this point.
And that's why there probably is an appropriate time window for a bigger, deeper frame of reference in this area. It's timely. We've been prepared for many, many years for television. We've seen pictures. We've seen videos on the internet. We've heard and seen testimony. Your book is an example of this. And the more people with credibility in positions of power that come forward and say, look, this is what I saw. And when you have people that are in the skies flying, and you have both on the radar and not on the radar, where these objects just disappear. I think probably the scariest thing to the human mind is that we can't control what we're seeing. We don't know exactly what it is. We don't know where it came from. We don't have a handle on it, and that's preventing further investigation on a formal level and the acknowledgement that it exists. But I think you and I are living at a time where in our lifetime, more and more people across the world are going to be ready to know that these are real and this is not a joke, that they're unidentified aerial phenomenon that we can't explain. I don't know what we'll learn if it moves this fast and can come in and out of sight this quickly, moving at speeds that are beyond anything we understand. But for sure, by being able to talk about it, by being able to report it, by people in high positions able to give testimonies of what they're seeing and recordings of this, more of us can become accepting that there's something that's occurring that we don't understand at all. At least we have a frame of reference that there's something that's happening that we don't understand, that we can't control, that's in the air. That's
right,
profound.
And I certainly think, you know, it would help if the U.S. government agencies within the government were willing to acknowledge that. And the point needs to be made that that acknowledgement has been made in other countries. And, you know, there hasn't been any kind of big panic or upheaval or any, you know, huge ramifications in the culture that would justify withholding such an acknowledgement. So I think you're right that more and more people can become aware of this, and I hope it filters up within the government structure, and that we can see some more greater openness there. And in terms of the discovery of what it is, I agree with you too that it's very difficult to pin. You know, when you have these things that can fly as fast as they do and come and go. But I also think, and this is what we're proposing in the book, that if our scientists cooperated with scientists in other countries and really put their minds to deciding and becoming proactive about trying to learn more about UFOs, I think there probably is more that they could learn. And we're putting out the idea that they have to actually make a conscious choice to focus on this, to capture UFOs via cameras, via other technology that maybe hasn't even been developed yet, but that once, you know, a shift has been made and there's an interest and a desire to learn more, and to possibly even be able to prove what they are, I think that's something that our best minds would be capable of doing, and we just want to sort of have the vision that this is the direction we should move, and that someday we're all going to know exactly what they are, hopefully.
I think that's a great vision, and I often wonder a certain mass of people, of beings that may not be receptive due to their religious affiliation and backgrounds. Even if a great majority of us find out, what are they going to deal with, these people? You see, what are they going to deal with? Wednesday?
Right. I mean, it is very troubling to lots of people for different reasons. And I think you're right. Religion is one of them. And, you know, prior sets of beliefs that people have, whether they be religious or philosophical. And there's also the aspects of fear that underlie this. That, you know, I mean, it's a big attitude shift. It's a big paradigm shift, really, to really be open to this. And to contemplate the possibility that, you know, we could be being visited by craft or whatever from somewhere else in the galaxy, or and not, you know, is a big it's a big deal. And it has a lot of ramifications for people for lots of different reasons. So, you know, and I think the book is trying to address what some of those might be, and we're addressing the taboo very directly, hoping to make it easier for people to sort of accept and gradually come to terms with this and to see that it's not a terrifying thing. It really doesn't have to be seen that way. Hopefully, you know, everyone can find their own way to come to terms with it because it does exist. There's nothing we can do. We can't make it go away, and we don't want to pretend that it's not there. So we really have no choice but to address it and find ways of dealing with it, each in our own way. But nonetheless, we can't ignore something that is physical and is real.
I love the fact that you are the bridge that you are of bringing this subject and this reality to people across the world in a digestible way where people can get it and all of a sudden have a stable frame of reference in which to inquire about this and to think about it. And I think you're doing an incredible public service by having written this book and doing the work that you've done and are doing. And I want to thank you for being a guest on It's Rainmaking Time, and I hope that you'll come back maybe with other guests as well to talk about the subject of UFOs. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking with, learning from, and listening to Leslie Kane. She's the author of the book UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. This is an incredible book. You all should have it. And you can find out more about her work at UFOsOnTheRecord.com. Leslie, thank you so much for being a guest. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, Kim, I mean, I really appreciate your show, and I appreciate the insight that comes through all your questions. You're very thoughtful, and it's been a fascinating interview for me, and I appreciate it very much. And I just hope that everybody will check out the book on UFOsOnTheRecord.com. By the way, Amazon has selling it at a real discount right now. It's not expensive if you go to Amazon.com. And I'm just, you know, I think it's a tool, as you said. It's a tool, it's a public service, and we can all participate by reading the book and spreading the word and getting the word out there about this book, because I think it can create change, and that's really the bottom line reason I did it. And so everybody can help in that process, and I just hope that they will consider doing that. And again, thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Many blessings to you, Leslie Kane.
Thank you, Kim.